Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. I'd like to welcome you. We have an empowering hour. Lots of commentaries today. No guest. Of course, we always begin with the latest on health and healing. We'll be looking at black currant nectar, what it does that really helps us, the inappropriate use of antibiotics, and what that does, how fish and fatty acid consumption lowers an important condition in women, how indigo rose tomatoes are really good for fighting diabetes, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases. Do you know what an indigo rose tomato is? Walking or cycling to work improves something, and a lot more on health and healing. Then from our environmental segment, we're going to show you the latest environmental disasters around the world, including the catastrophic environmental conditions in Palestine. And this is from Bethlehem University, an interesting study. Life on $2 a day, it's more common than what you might imagine. Not in the Sudan, in the United States, millions of Americans are earning less than $2 a day. From our health impact, Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation and their vaccine empire is being challenged in court in India by the Indian Supreme Court. I'll give you the latest on that. Also, the water mafia, something new you haven't heard about. J.D. Hayes of Natural News talks about California's future. Residents throughout the state may soon be forced to buy water on the black market, just like in India. That means it will also start happening in Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, and other places. Never thought it would happen in the United States? Think again. It is. And then I'm going to take a look at something that needs an examination. On our last program, I read a commentary from the Rabbi Michael Lerner, his perspective on bringing peace to the Middle East and how the conflict between the Jewish state and the Palestinian people is not going to work based upon the people in power and how they're doing it. So I gave a presentation. We had a lot of very positive feedback from around the world on that, and I thank you for that input. I thought that he was one of the most sensitive and caring people because he's pro-Israeli. He's certainly pro-Jewish, but he talked extensively about the Judaism of love and compassion and forgiveness and working with others. Today, I'm going to share one part of a debate at the oldest debating society in the world, that at Oxford University. And there were four people who were anti-Islam, I mean, rabidly so. So one of the professors got up to speak about Islam. I'd like for you to hear it, and then I'd like your feedback. I'd like for you to call in and share your points of view. Our call-in number is 888-874-4888. Keep this in mind before you listen to what he has to say. Do you remember that Christian fundamentalist, that Zionist Christian, who was stoking anti-Islamic fears a few years ago? He just died recently. You had Jimmy Swaggart. You had Pat Robinson. You had much of the religious right, the rapturists, the people who are living at what they consider the end of times, who believe that the planet was founded 6,000 years ago, where humans and dinosaurs coexisted. Those people are known as Christian Zionists. And they are the ones who are strongly impacting our foreign policy towards conflicts around the world. They're the ones who you see frequently, or their spokespersons, as experts on the talking shows as the people who we should listen to, they do not represent the type of Christianity, the values I learned in the first Christian church growing up. In the same way, we must ask ourselves, if you look at some of the most radical of the Christian fundamentalists, they are not representative of what most Christians believe and how they live their lives, then why haven't we in the United States looked at the most radical of the Islamic leaders around the world who advocate extreme interpretations of Islam versus the vast majority? And in the United States, more and more, I hear people are simply anti-Islam, the Islamophobic, using the example that it's a religion of hatred, a religion of jihad, a religion of destruction. I might point out that so too could I show you in the Bible, the Christian Bible, that we could be equally devastating, it depending upon our interpretation. That is the backdrop and the context to hear what he has to say. But I think we should hear it. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. Most Americans never eat black currants. First, they only come once a year. You'll see red currants and black currants and yellow currants. They're tart. They don't have a good aftertaste, very bitter, but they're extremely nutritious. A tremendous amount of vitamin C, far more than oranges, grapefruits, any of the citrus. They're not even the same league. They're so packed with vitamins, nutrients, and antioxidants. So probably the best way to get it is if you get it into a juice or a concentrate. In fact, I just had some black currant seed concentrate this morning to take down some of the vitamins I take. It was bitter, but it's okay. It only takes a minute. So keep that in mind when you're going to take it. But here's the latest from the Journal of Dietary Supplements and from a professor, Alexander Hutchison, says daily consumption of black currant nectar for 8 days may reduce muscle damage and inflammation after exercise. This was done at the University of in San Antonio, Texas. 16 ounces per day of blackberry currant nectar was associated with a substantial risk in reduction in creatine kinase, a blood marker for muscle damage. So we can have that if we're exercising, and it can reduce the damage from the exercise. Cyclists, runners, weightlifters, people who play tennis, soccer, you're damaging muscles. This can help repair it. We overuse antibiotics. In fact, we're way over the top, and that's what's caused antibiotic-resistant microorganisms. This is the latest from the Infectious Control and Hospital Epidemiology Journal, and it says, from the CDC, this is from the Center for Disease Control, inappropriate use of antibiotics responsible for $163 million in potential avoidable hospital costs, which means that when you're not, quote, the overuse of antibiotics is an industry-wide public health issue that is occurring across all care settings. Sometimes in an effort to do whatever it takes to fight a serious infection, clinicians use multiple antibiotics to treat the same infection. This practice can contribute to antimicrobial resistance, put patient safety at risk, and increase cost. We hope these findings will help to enhance the antimicrobial stewardship initiatives that the majority of U.S. hospitals already have in place today, end quote. Quote, researchers found 70% of potential unnecessary therapies represented three specific drug combinations. So what you're doing in lay language is you have a cold, you have the flu, you're given an antibiotic, bad medicine. Not just bad medicine, dangerous to you. Why? Because colds and flus are precipitated by a weakened immune system, generally stress, not enough rest, and therefore your natural immune system is not able to target, trap, and kill those microorganisms that cause the flu and the pneumonia, and other conditions. Those are viral in nature, like the rhinovirus, for example. Antibiotics are only good for bacteria, not viruses. But it gets worse. Not only are you wasting the money to see the doctor, get a prescription, take the antibiotic, but as you get worse, they frequently up the dosage of the antibiotic or give you more than one antibiotic. What that does is it does not get you well any faster. Rest, really hydrating, with lots of green vegetable juice and fruit juices, fresh made, organic, and vitamin C, manuka honey in green tea, wild oregano oil, 20 drops, and bee propolis, paldiarco, and astragalus, echinacea, all together, that is what gets you well. And then when you can tolerate it, taking some garlic and ginger and lemon in a juice diluted, such as watermelon. That is what I use to help the people I know, and it works. Taking the antibiotic is only going to destroy the good bacteria, changing then the whole milieu, hence the diarrhea and or constipation, the bloating, the gas, the distension, the aches and the pains that you feel when you have this. So that's what it's also saying. Now, if they really cared about having too much antibiotics, get it out of the animals. Why do we give antibiotics to animals? There's only two reasons. One is because they found when cows and pigs are given antibiotics, they gain more weight without eating more food. So it's economically beneficial to give antibiotics to get the animal at a higher weight because they sell animals by weight. And two, the cruel, inhumane conditions of all animal husbandry in the United States on a commercial level means that they're kept in unclean containment areas, feedlots. They're fed on conveyor belts frequently or fed in troughs, and they're fed in mixtures of offal, of cardboard, of all forms of items that are incompatible with life. But they're allowed to legally because their lobbyists influenced the Department of Agriculture and they got their way. That's how it works. So you got a very sick animal that's highly stressed and it is very prone to infection because they cannot clean out the manure. I've seen feedlots that had animals standing up to their knees in feces. That breeds infection. Now, you don't see that when you get your steak, but that's the reality of it. So get rid of eating animals, get antibiotics out of animal husbandry, and you wouldn't have so much of that antibiotic being passed on into humans, making us susceptible. Fatty acid consumption is associated with a lower risk of hearing loss in women. This is from Medical News, published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Quote, researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital found that the consumption of two or more servings of fish per week was associated with a lower risk of hearing loss in women. And, quote, acquired hearing loss is a highly prevalent and often disabling chronic health condition. Although a decline in hearing is often considered an inevitable aspect of aging, the identification of several potential modifiable risk factors has provided new insight into possibilities for prevention and delay of acquired hearing loss. And this is where they said the omega-3 fatty acids, the long chain omega-3 fatty acids, were associated with a lower risk. And this is a part of the Nurses' Health Study of 1,038,093 person-year follow-up. So, it's a big study. And they're saying, quote, consumption of any type of fish, tuna, dark fish, light fish, shellfish, tend to be associated with low risk. Okay, they're accurate, but that's not the best advice. Why? Because we don't want to eat fish. Fish suffer also. Fish suffer pain. Most of the fish that we're eating in the world today is polluted. Where do you think they get all that all-you-can-eat shrimp at some of these shrimp houses? Have you asked them? Would you ever eat shrimp, all you could eat, if you saw that they were being grown in human and animal waste pools from Thailand and China, where there's no one overseeing it and no standards. These are extremely toxic. They're loaded with chemicals and heavy metals. Now, you won't see any of that, and you probably won't even taste it, but it's there, and now it's in you. That's one reason not to do that. Separately, we now know that from hemp oil, from avocado oil, and other plants, flaxseed, for example, we can get the same quality, even higher quality, DHA, which is the most positive, beneficial fraction of the omega-3 fatty acids. We don't have to eat fish in order to obtain that. So the takeaway message is this. Most women will begin to lose their hearing depending upon their environmental exposure, their workplace exposure, their recreational time exposure, how loud they keep the radio up, which then means that they have to turn it up louder just to hear it because of loss of hearing. And by taking the omega-3 fatty acids, it could help prevent that. On Sunday, I finished my workout in the park with our Natural Living Running and Walking Club, and it was a wonderful group of people. We're doing a really strong 18-mile workout. And I go to the farmer's market. Now, there's a farmer's market on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, right in front of the Museum of Natural History. It runs the whole distance, which is about 3 blocks. And I love to support this small handcrafted vendors, those that make the natural candles, those that have any of the products that they have grown themselves, microgreens, which are very expensive, by the way. They were charging $12 for 3 ounces. So that's a, little bag runs you a lot. But they're microgreens. They have a lot more power and taste. They're more unique than a regular green. But the tomatoes were really what were beautiful and fresh, non-sprayed tomatoes. And you'll see that there's now some very dark, looking almost black, tomatoes. And most people don't eat them because it doesn't remind them of a red tomato. But those are indigo rose tomatoes. And that dark tomato is extremely beneficial. It is far healthier than normal organic red varieties. If you have all of them are organic, but if you have a yellow, a green, red, a rose, and a dark indigo, the dark indigo, hands down, is your healthiest tomato. And scientists bred purple tomatoes that contain more anthocyanins, an antioxidant that helps fight several diseases, with normal red varieties. And there are some dark-colored tomatoes, but indigo is the only real black tomato. And it has been modified, crossbred, to have all these nutrients. So just want to let you know, because I saw a lot of them, and people generally don't buy them because it doesn't look like a tomato, but it's got more of the nutrients in it. Power walking. Just brisk walking. Walk as fast as your arms can move, nonstop, ideally for about 45 minutes to an hour, 6 days a week. This is the latest from the University of East Anglia. That's in the United Kingdom. And it says, quote, walking or cycling to work is better for people's mental health than driving to work. A report published today reveals that people who stopped driving and started walking or cycling to work benefited from improved well-being. These benefits come on top of the physical health benefits of walking and cycling. They're already well documented. It was the psychological well-being. And they said from the Norwich Medical School, quote, One surprising finding was that commuters reported feeling better when they traveled by public transport compared to driving. You might think that things like disruption to services or crowds of commuters might have been a cause of considerable stress, but as buses or trains also give people time to relax, read, socialize, there's usually an associated walk to the bus stop or railroad station and appears to cheer people up. So they looked at 18,000 people and they found that those who walked felt better for the day. And one final thing, wow, does this remind me of the work of Dr. Otto Warburg, who won the Nobel Prize, a physiologist. He found that people who live at high elevations are less likely to have metastasizing cancers or cancer at all. Not that you couldn't, less likely. And that meant that it was the oxygen factor. This is the latest. Quote, this is from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, did a study finding that low oxygen levels could be the blame for the spread of at least one type of cancer, giving scientists clues to more effective treatments. Now, cancer cells, according to the Natural Society, are abnormal cells that grow, multiply, and control, but they are far more complex than simple growing because they're damaged. And according to the researchers from Johns Hopkins University, low oxygen levels within cancer cells trigger the increased production of two proteins, RHOA and ROCK1. These proteins are known to give cancer cells movement and the ability to easily spread. So studying breast cancer cells, the scientists explained that when cancer cells spread, they undergo a number of physical changes to make such movement possible. This includes a production of filaments in hands, allowing them to contract and reach, pulling themselves along and latching onto other surfaces. Well, the RHOA and the ROCK1 are known to play an important role in the production of these filaments and hands. Until this study, it was largely unknown what caused the levels of these proteins to be high. Now, however, we have a clue. Suppressed using oxygen to wipe out these diseases. Quote, this is from Dr. Greg Simonez of Johns Hopkins. He says, as tumor cells multiply, the interior of the tumor begins to run out of oxygen because it isn't being fed by blood vessels. The lack of oxygen activates the hypoxia-induced factors, which are master control proteins that switch on many genes that help cells adapt to the scarcity of oxygen. Further, these changes allow the cancer cells to break away from the centralized tumor where they can reach the blood vessels and spread throughout the body. So, when you have oxygen depleted, you're sitting, you're laying down, you're working at a desk, oxygen depleted, then that's when the cancer can grow and spread. However, the reverse is true too. Instead of dealing with hypoxia, what if you put oxygen into the cells? High oxygen, then lower cancer rate of growth. Hence, exercise. Exercising in a higher altitude forces the body to better utilize the oxygen, forcing more oxygen to be utilized, in which case then, like hyperbaric oxygen or oxygen therapy, you're able to kill or reduce the growth of cancer. One more reason why, with cancer, you absolutely should be exercising, if possible. I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. And when we come back, I want you to hear, now we have all these so-called experts. They're all paid consultants from the war industry that's been privatized. But I want you to hear one person who absolutely positively felt we should not go into Baghdad in Iraq. We shouldn't have troops there, that they would end up being killed, and no American death is worth this. We'll hear him as soon as we come back from this few seconds of music.
Do you think that the U.S. or U.N. forces should have moved into Baghdad?
No.
Why not?
Because if we'd gone to Baghdad, we would have been all alone. There wouldn't have been anybody else with us. It would have been a U.S. occupation of Iraq. None of the Arab forces that were willing to fight with us in Kuwait were willing to invade Iraq. Once you got to Iraq and took it over and took down Saddam Hussein's government, then what are you going to put in its place? That's a very volatile part of the world, and if you take down the central government in Iraq, you can easily end up seeing pieces of Iraq fly off. Part of it the Syrians would like to have to the west. Part of eastern Iraq the Iranians would like to claim, fought over for 8 years. In the north, you've got the Kurds, and if the Kurds spin loose and join with the Kurds in Turkey, then you threaten the territorial integrity of Turkey. It's a quagmire if you go that far and try to take over Iraq. The other thing was casualties. Everyone was impressed with the fact that we were able to do our job with as few casualties as we had. But for the 146 Americans killed in action and for their families, it wasn't a cheap war. And the question for the president in terms of whether or not we went on to Baghdad and took additional casualties in an effort to get Saddam Hussein was how many additional dead Americans is Saddam worth? And our judgment was not very many, and I think we got it right.
You think you got it right? Well, that was then. That was 1992. But in 2003, you were willing to sacrifice 5,000 dead Americans, over 40,000 injured, over 400,000 with Gulf War Syndrome post-traumatic stress disorder, and now 900,000 homeless Gulf War veterans. Gee whiz, how we forget. That was Dick Cheney. Also, what do you think is the likely outcome when we start bombing in Syria? Let me think. Libya. Let me think. Failed state. Moderate terrorist? I don't know a moderate terrorist. Can you define it? You train them. You give them weapons. You did that in Libya. What happened there? Where did they go? Oh, I see. We're fighting those moderate terrorists now. The ISIL, ISIS group, Islamic State. Nothing learned. From our environmental segment, this is from Bethlehem University. I thought this was interesting. It's short, but it makes a point that I have not seen made anywhere else in the media. Quote, the first scientific studies highlight an environmental catastrophe in Palestine. Over the last, I'm quoting from Bethlehem University, quote, over the last 40 years, Occupy Palestine has witnessed a catastrophic decline in biodiversity. Loss of habitat, desertification, pollution of water sources have all been linked to the occupation by Israeli forces. This summer, scientific research led by Professor Masson at New Palestine Museum of Natural History at Bethlehem University was published in the journal, Jordan Journal of Biological Sciences, entitled Decline in Vertebrate Diversity in Bethlehem, Palestine. The speed of decline in biodiversity due to habitat destruction in Palestine over the last few decades has been catastrophic. Samples in the Bethlehem area have found that 31 species of mammals commonly witnessed in the 1960s and early 70s, 13 species have already completely disappeared, including 4 to 7 varieties of bat, 8 species of carnivore, badgers, and native gazelle have also reached the point of critical endangerment. Similarly, 1/3 of species observed a few decades ago were not seen in more recent surveys. Gone. The human population has not been immune from the ongoing environmental catastrophe. In a 2013 paper on genotoxicity published in the International Journal of Environmental Studies, the doctor, one of the master students showed the effects that the Israeli industrial settlement in Shalfit is having on DNA of local Palestinians. In a sample of blood from this community, the percentage of cells with aberrations stood at 4.08%, far above the level that has been considered normal or healthy in individuals, which is generally 0.4%. Such aberrations increase the incidence of cancers, infertility, and congenital abnormalities. Environmental damage in Palestine is due to Israeli colonization, population growth, global climate change, and unregulated industrial development. Israeli policies have greatly exacerbated these problems. In particular, research highlights the destruction of Palestinian villages, long structured to be in the balance with nature for thousands of years, the creation of millions of refugees living in unsustainable conditions, and bringing in settlers from abroad. Over 600,000 settlers have moved to the West Bank since 1967. Other problems highlighted in the ongoing research are impact on draining the Hula wetlands, the diversion of headwaters of the Jordan Valley, and the impact of annexation and segregation walls. If nothing changes, the doctor forecasts that the process of decline in biodiversity, desertification, and polluting of water sources will only get worse, while temperatures in the West Bank could rise by as much as 5 degrees over the next 30 years and rainfall decline by 25%. So, thought that was interesting. Something else. Do you remember at virtually all the media was talking about the justification for bombing the hospital was that there were rockets being fired. This is from Truthout. Garth Porter, quote, "A video distributed by the Israeli military in July suggesting that Palestinian fighters had fired from the Al-Wafa Rehabilitation and Geriatric Hospital in Gaza City was not shot during the recent Israeli attack on Gaza, and both audio and video clips were manipulated to cover up the fact they were from an entirely different incident," a Truthout investigation has revealed. The video, released by the Israeli Defense Forces on July 23rd, the same day Israeli airstrikes destroyed Al-Wafa, was widely reported by pro-Israeli publications and websites as proving that the hospital was destroyed because Hamas had turned the hospital into a military facility. But the video clip showing apparent firing from an annex to the hospital was actually shot during Israelis' 2008-09 Operation Cast Lead, and the audio clip accompanying it was from an incident unrelated to Al-Wafa. The misleading video was only the last in a series of IDF information pieces about the hospital that included false claims that Hamas rockets had been launched from the hospital grounds or near it, and that the hospital had been damaged by an attack on the launching site. So, misinformation and no challenge by the American media. Now we're going to go to a relatively short piece of a debate, and you're hearing the last presenter. The first four were all strongly anti-Islamic, not just terrorists. This is the one at the end that I felt was interesting in how he responded. Then after this, we will open our call lines for talkback. This is the Union Debate Society, Union, or Oxford University.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Assalamu alaikum. Lovely to see you all here tonight. We are having a very entertaining night, are we not, with some very interesting things being said. From the other side of the house tonight. Let me begin by saying, as a Muslim, as a representative of Islam, I would consider myself an ambassador for Islam, a believer in Islam, a follower of Islam and its prophet. So, in that capacity, let me begin by apologizing to Anne-Marie for the Bali bombings. I apologize for the role of my religion and me and my people, for the killing of Theo van Gogh, for 7/7. Yes, that was all of us. That was Islam, that was Muslims, that was the Quran. I mean, astonishing claims to make in the very first speech on a day like today, where the Conservative Prime Minister of the United Kingdom is having to come out and point out that these kind of views are anathema. And I believe you're trying to stand for the Labour Party to become an MP in Brighton. If you do, and you make these comments, I'm guessing you'll have the whip withdrawn from you. But then again, UKIP's on the rise. They'll take you, the BNP. They might have something to say about your views.
This is what Mehdi Hassan always does.
By the way, just on a factual point, since we heard a lot about the second speaker, about how backward we Muslims all are, on a factual point, you said that Islam was born in Saudi Arabia. Islam was born in 610 AD. Saudi Arabia was born in 1932 AD. So you were only 1,322 years off. Not bad? Not bad start there. Talking of maths, by the way, a man named Al-Khwarizmi was one of the greatest mathematicians of all time, a Muslim, worked in the golden age of Islam. He's the guy who came up with not just algebra, but algorithms. Without algorithms, you wouldn't have laptops. Without laptops, Daniel Johnson tonight wouldn't have been able to print out his speech in which he came to berate us Muslims for holding back the advance and intellectual achievements of the West, which all happened without any contribution from anyone else other than the Judeo-Christian people of Europe. In fact, Daniel David Levering, the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author of The Golden Crucible, points out that there would be no Renaissance, there would be no Reformation in Europe without the role played by Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd and some of the great Muslim theologians, philosophers, scientists in bringing Greek texts to Europe. As for this being our university, I will leave that to the imagination as to who is our and who is there. I studied here too. An astonishing set of speeches so far making this case tonight. A mixture of just cherry-picked quotes, facts and figures, self-serving, selective, a farrago of distortions, misrepresentations, misinterpretations, misquotations. Daniel talked about my article in the New Statesman, which got me a lot of flack, where I talked about the anti-Semitism that is prevalent in some parts of the Muslim community, which indeed it is. Of course, I didn't say in that piece that it was caused by the religion of Islam. In fact, modern anti-Semitism in the Middle East was imported from, finish the sentence, Christian, Judeo-Christian Europe, where I believe some certain bad things happened to the Jewish people. In fact, Tom Friedman, Jewish-American columnist in the New York Times, told me in this very chamber last week that he believed, had Muslims been running Europe in the 1940s, 6 million extra Jews would still be alive today. So I'm not going to take lessons in anti-Semitism from someone who's here to defend the Judeo-Christian values of a continent that murdered 6 million Jews. Moving swiftly on. Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm about to make that point. No, I'm about to make that point. You're right. I agree with you 110%. That is my point. I don't think Europe is evil or bad. I'm a very proud European. I don't want to judge Europe on the basis, but if we're going to play this gutter game where we pull out the Bali bombing and we pull out examples of anti-Semitism in Islamic community, then of course I'm going to come back and say, well, hold on. I mean, look, let's be very clear. Daniel here was a last-minute replacement for Douglas Murray, who had to pull out. And Douglas and I have a well-documented differences, but to be fair to Douglas, as to be fair to Anne-Marie and to Peter, atheists. Atheists see all religions as evil, violent, threatening. What the problem I have with Daniel's speech is that Daniel comes here to mount this robust defense of Christianity, forgetting that his fellow Christians, people who said they were acting in the name of Jesus, gave us the Crusades, the Spanish Inquisition, the anti-Jewish pogroms, European colonialism in Africa and Asia, the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda, not to mention countless arson and bomb attacks on abortion clinics in the United States of America to this very day. I would like a little bit of humility from Daniel first before he begins lecturing other communities and other faiths on violence, terror and intolerance. But, no thank you. Some water. But I would say this, to address the gentleman's very valid point here, I'm not going to play that game. I don't actually believe that Christianity is a religion of violence and hate because of what the LRA does in Uganda or what crusaders did to Jews and Muslims in Jerusalem when they took back the city in the 12th or 13th or whatever century it was. I believe that Christianity, like Islam, like pretty much every mainstream religion, is based on love and compassion and faith. I do follow a religion in which 113 out of the 114 chapters of the Quran begins by introducing the God of Islam as a God of mercy and compassion. I would not have it any other way. I don't follow a religion which introduces my God to me as a God of war, as some kind of Greek God of wrath, as a God of hate and injustice. Not at all. As Adam pointed out, you go through the Quran and you see the mercy and the love and the justice. And yes, you have verses that refer to warfare and violence. Of course it does. This is not a motion about pacifism. I'm not here to argue that Islam is a pacifistic faith. It is not. Islam allows military action, violence in certain limited contexts. And yes, a minority of Muslims do take it out of that context. But is it religious? We talked about Woolwich. Daniel and Anne-Marie have suggested that it's definitely religion that's behind all of this. Well, actually, what I find so amusing tonight is we're having a debate about Islam, and the opposition tonight have come forward. We have a graduate in law, a graduate in modern history, a graduate in chemistry. And, you know, I admire all of their intellects and their abilities, but we don't have anyone who's actually an expert on Islam, a scholar of Islam, a historian of Islam, a speaker of Arabic, even a terrorism expert or a security expert or a pollster, let alone to talk about what Muslims believe or think. Instead, we have people coming here, putting forward these views, putting forward these sweeping opinions. Listen to Professor Robert Pape of the University of Chicago, one of America's leading terrorism experts, who, unlike our esteemed opposition tonight, studied every single case of suicide terrorism between 1980 and 2005, 315 cases in total. And he concluded, and I quote, "There is little connection between suicide terrorism and Islamic fundamentalism or any of the world's religions. Rather, what nearly all suicide terrorist attacks have in common is a specific secular and strategic goal to compel modern democracies to withdraw military forces from territory that the terrorists consider to be their homeland." And the irony is, when we talk about terrorism, the irony is that the opposition and the Muslim terrorists, the Al-Qaeda types, actually have one thing in common. Because they both believe that Islam is a warlike, violent religion. They both agree on that. They have everything in common. Osama bin Laden would be nodding along to everything he said tonight from the opposition side. He agrees with them. The problem is that mainstream Muslims don't. The majority of Muslims around the world don't. In fact, a gentleman here started quoting all sorts of polls. Gallup carried out the biggest poll of Muslims around the world, of 50,000 Muslims in 35 countries. 93% of Muslims rejected 9/11 and suicide attacks. And of the 7% who didn't, they all, when polled and focus grouped, cited political reasons for their support for violence, not religious reasons. And as for Islamic scholars and what they say, well, Daniel talks about our University of Oxford. We'll go down to Oxford's Centre for Islamic Studies, get hold of a man named Sheikh Afifi Al-Akiti, who is a massively well-credentialed and well-respected Islamic scholar who has studied across the world, who in the days after 7/7 published a fatwa denouncing terrorism in the name of Islam, calling for the protection of all non-combatants at all times and describing suicide bombings as an innovation with no basis in Islamic law. Go and listen to Sheikh Tahir Al-Qadri, one of Pakistan's most famous Islamic scholars, who published a 600-page fatwa condemning the killing of all innocents and all suicide bombings unconditionally without any ifs or buts. There's nothing new here. This is mainstream Islam, mainstream scholarship, which has said this for years. You don't go out and kill people willy-nilly in the high street or anywhere else on a bus or a mall based on verses of the Quran that you cherry-pick without any context, any understanding, any interpretation or any commentary. Please. Well, it
doesn't happen, apparently.
I didn't say it doesn't happen at all. I never said it didn't happen. I don't blame Islam. Yes, it's a very good point. And a lot of us are campaigning against that. And we're campaigning against it in the name of Islam. We're campaigning against it in the name of various interpretations of Islam. Anne-Marie comes and scares us with her talk of Sharia law. I would like to see the book of Sharia law. It doesn't exist. People argue over what Sharia law is. And you empower the extremists by saying there is only one version. You empower them all. I don't believe you
several
took any interruptions,
countries.
Anne-Marie, so I think you should stay there for a moment.
Several countries.
Here's what we're dealing with. Here's what
countries.
We're dealing with. We are dealing... I took your point. Here we are dealing with a 1,400-year-old global religion followed by 1.6 billion people in every corner of the world, a quarter of humanity, of all backgrounds, cultures, ethnicities, and yet the opposition tonight wants to generalize, stereotype, smear in order to desperately win this debate. And here's my question, if we're going to generalize and smear. If, okay, people say yesterday's bombers, and we've got to be careful, there's a trial going on, were yesterday's attackers, motivated by Islam? Big debate. I don't believe they were. Let's say they were. Let's say Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, was motivated by Islam. Let's assume, for sake of argument, that Richard Reeves, the shoe bomber, was motivated by Islam. If Islam is responsible for these killings, if Islam is what is motivating these people, and Islam is therefore not a religion of peace or religion of war, then ask yourself this question. Why aren't the rest of us doing it? Why is it such a tiny minority of Muslims are interpreting their religion in the way that the opposition claim they are? Let's assume there are 16,000 suicide bombers in the world. There aren't. Let's assume there are, for the sake of argument. That's 0.001% of the Muslim population globally. What about the other 99.99% of Muslims who the opposition tonight either ignore or smear? The reality is that the rest of us aren't blowing ourselves up tonight. The reality is that the opposition came here tonight not worried about the fact that me and Adam might pull open our jackets and blow ourselves up tonight, because we're followers of a warlike warrior religion which wants to take over Europe and Daniel's university. The issue is this. The issue is this. the opposition can tell us tonight, and Peter Atkins is here, one of our great atheist intellectuals, can tell us tonight, can answer this question tonight, why don't the vast majority of Muslims around the world behave as violently and aggressively as a tiny minority of politically motivated extremists, then they might as well give up and stop pretending they have anything relevant to say about Islam or Muslims as a whole. Ladies and gentlemen, let me just say this to you. Think about what the opposite of this motion is. If you vote no tonight, think about what you're saying the opposite motion is. That Islam isn't a religion of peace, it's a religion of war, of violence, of terror, of aggression. That the people who follow Islam, me, my wife, my retired parents, my six-year-old child, that 1.8 million of your fellow British residents and citizens, that 1.6 billion people across the world, your fellow human beings, are all followers, promoters, believers in a religion of violence. Do you really think that? Do you really believe that to be the case? They say that in the Oxford Union, the most famous debate was in 1933 when Adolf Hitler looked out for the result of the King and Country motion, where they voted against fighting for King and Country, and Hitler was listening out for the result. Well, tonight, 80 years on, there are two groups of people around the world who I would argue are waiting for the result of tonight's vote. There are the millions of peaceful, non-violent, law-abiding Muslims both in the UK, Europe, Asia, Africa and beyond, who see Islam as the source of their identity, as a source of spiritual fulfillment, of hope, of solace. And there are the phobes, the haters, the bigots out there who want to push the clash of civilizations, who want to divide all of us into them and us and ours and their. Ladies and gentlemen, I urge you all not to fuel the arguments of the phobes and bigots. Don't legitimize their divisions. Don't legitimize their hate. Trust those Muslims who you know, who you've met, who you hear, who don't believe in violence, who do want you to hear the peaceful message of the Quran as they believe it to be taught to the majority of Muslims, the Islam of peace and compassion and mercy, the Islam of the Quran, not of Al-Qaeda. Ladies and gentlemen, I beg to propose this motion to the House. I urge you to vote yes tonight. Thank you very much for your time.
That's not a discussion or a debate that you would hear in the United States. I said I would open the lines to hear your feedback for a few minutes. Let's say hello to Imani from New York City. Hi, Imani. Your turn.
Yes, Gary. Peace. This is Imani. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you.
I'm very good. I'm glad to hear. I am amazed and I am very pleased that you ran that particular piece. I was not aware of that debate. I happen to be Muslim, and to have something that comes across as food for thought, we appreciate very much that you took that time to present a balance in understanding and hopefully enlightenment. And that's all I want to say for now. And thank you.
I'm happy to do it. Nina from Queens, your turn, Nina.
Standing on the opposite side of this debate, I'm a Muslim, and I'm a writer, and I know what Quran says. So I want to come in your show and debate on this, because we cannot cover it in a minute. But believe me, I will show you, piece by piece, what it has done to the humanity. I disagree completely. They're a bunch of liars. That the speaker who was talking, he just denying everything and pushing his ideas, saying that it is a religion of peace. Look at the Middle East, how they're cutting off the heads. Where did it come from? It happened 1500 years ago. Prophet Muhammad himself ordered killing, and I have a bunch of books. Name, time, the way it was done, even the children, mother who had an extramarital affair was killed up the
All right, Nina, because, you've given us your position, but keep in mind that what you do not see is you do not see the 99.99%, as he said, and he is correct, of Muslims cutting off anyone's head. And also be very careful when you open that door, saying that Islam is a religion of violence. All religions can have violence if you look carefully at the text. Now, I've done so. I have over 167 different statements from the Old Testament alone that would equal or surpass anything that Christianity would be allowed to do if someone chose to use that interpretation without looking at the larger context. And so you have to look at all religions and their practitioners to see whether or not they are promoting the peaceful side or the negative side. That's what he was saying. That's my interpretation of it, but I appreciate you calling and sharing yours, and I will invite you on for a debate on this. We'll have time for one last call. Let's say hello to Phil from Brooklyn. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Gary. How are you? Pleasure, sir.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment on a few things real quick. The speech was, I thought, you know, outstanding, but I think for us to evolve as a species, we need to sort of put politics, capitalism, as well as religion aside. And that's, you know, just my opinion.
We can't put politics aside because right now the political process controls all other aspects of our lives. You're right, as this one woman on the weekend when she kissed her husband in California, in Los Angeles, and she was arrested because she was profiled, because she thought the police thought she was a prostitute. That's the political process. And if you don't address it at the local level, the regional level, the state level, and the national level, then when one day you wake up and you have no currency, everything's electronic, when you're on a profiled list because of your ethnicity, your race, your age, whatever it may be, your political position, then you realize that it is only through grassroots political action for progressive causes that you have the right to live a life in peace and in harmony. So I would take that approach. I appreciate your call, Phil. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary.
We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening and sharing your input and thoughts with us. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi, who's standing by. Hi, Luann. Do we have Luann on? Then we have one more. KB from New Jersey. Hi, KB. Your turn.
Hello, Gary. How are you today?
Good.
That's good. That's good. I was listening to the speaker that you had on, and I would like to commend you for that. I have, my life has been greatly improved since I found you on the internet one day. But from everything that he was saying, I live in northern New Jersey, actually in Newark, New Jersey, and here we have a little bit of everything. We have Jews, Christians, Muslims. We also have Buddhists, and we have Sikhs. And one thing that I have seen going throughout all of them, because I've been to every single temple, mosque, organization, masjid, I've been to all of them, because that's just stuff that I do. And there's one thing. Everybody, like you said, has a thread in which violence can be justified. However, I've also noticed that when they say that violence is justified, that violence can only be given under the authority of God. And the last time I checked, nobody in this modern era has actually spoken to God. So anybody who claims that they're taking up violence in the name of religion, who have not read the second part of pretty much every single one of those directives as if it's ordained by God, are basically not participating in their religion or their beliefs. They're actually doing the opposite.
KB, you're absolutely correct, but I would offer a different opinion. I believe that our Representative King from New York, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Ronald Reagan, George Bush, all speak to God. That's how they are convinced that we should be violent. So you see, you better be careful about who says they're speaking with God. All the best to you, KB. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day, Gary.
I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on the next program.